You're listening to a Day1.fm show.
Welcome back to Diaspora.nz. It has been a long time coming, nearly 7 years since the first season was recorded back in late 2017. Our goal now is to seek out and profile the hidden gems, the best founders, operators, researchers, and emerging leaders of the great Kiwi expat community. And we're kicking off season two with a banger. Hamish McKenzie was a frustrated journalist back in 2017 when he co-founded Substack. Today, having achieved something close to verb status synonymous with online publishing, Substack is, in his words, a new economic engine for culture. It's providing the infrastructure for thousands of writers, podcasters, and other creators around the world. Today, we're talking about Hamish's journey, Substack's evolution, its role and stance on the culture wars unfolding live and around the world, and where he sees it all going next. Let's hit the episode. Thanks for listening. Welcome to Diaspora.nz. I thought it was only fitting that the first podcast of season two, now hosted on Substack, should feature none other than Hamish, one of the founders of Substack. Welcome, man. It's so good to have you.
Yeah, thanks. I'm happy to be here. Exciting conversation.
Kick us off. I mean, help build some suspense for us. What is Substack?
I hate this question, man. It's like, we don't have a like crafted elevator pitch for it, which is a problem. But I basically call it a publishing platform for writers and creators. Creators, I add now. We started off very focused on writers, very focused on paid newsletters, but it has evolved a lot. So on Substack, you can publish a newsletter / blog, or you can be publishing and hosting a podcast. It could be a video show, and it has a whole lot of community features around it, which are either in the app, which is the Substack app, or on your own Substack site. Or you could just have the classic get everything by email and don't interact too much experience.
Classic Kiwi, you're being far too humble here. I would be very surprised if anyone listening wasn't a subscriber to a big handful of Substacks of their own, and you've taken a real place in the center of the internet's publishing engines. So I'm excited to dig into that.
Yeah, I mean, okay, I could give you the more grandiose version, which is that we're trying to build a new economic engine for culture. So it's sort of a business model for writing, or a business model for podcasting and show making, the independent creative or the independent publications that don't require you to be plugged into the mainstream media infrastructure. And it's working well. We've got everyone on the platform, from like hobbyist knitting bloggers to major authors and music stars, and some pretty interesting publications coming up through the ranks too.
Excited to go deeper on Substack, but let's dial back the clock first, because I had a lot of fun preparing for this, because man, you've written a lot and put a lot out there. But to go all the way back, perhaps you're best known as the editor of The Critic magazine, Otago, 2004.
Yep. Most famous of being editor of Critic. My proudest achievement.
Holds a sweet spot in many hearts. But tell me about the early sort of getting into writing. You obviously figured out that you want to be an author or a journalist very early on. And I don't know if The Critic was a part of that journey. But what sort of inspired you to start with?
I think I wanted to be a journalist since high school. Seemed like a good job where you get to talk to interesting people all the time, mix of indoor, outdoor work, get to immerse yourself in stories. I was always going to go to Otago. I grew up in central Otago, grew up in Alexandra. So I was going to go to Otago because that was a fun university to go to, and it's good university, is relatively close by. And they didn't have a journalism program. So I did English as my major and volunteered for the student magazine, and then worked my way up through the ranks of the student magazine until eventually I took it over as editor. That was in 2003.
The best way to learn a thing is obviously not to start it, but to actually get undo it. So The Critic ticks that box. And I found in my research a reference to one of your columns called ODT Watch, which was sort of commenting on the local newspaper at the time. But there's something that jumped out to me, which was that you were one of the contributors, or the one of the ODT Watch columnists who actually put his name to his work. And it came with this quote, again, in the archives here, but you know, if you're writing a serious point like that, I think you should put your name to it, because you ought to be held to account, just as you hold the people that you're writing to account. Do you believe that to this day? And how has that transitioned into an approach on pseudonymity online, on Substack, on Twitter, or elsewhere?
That column was called Hard Copy, and it later was carried on by a bunch of pretenders who then called it the ODT Watch. But, you know, I guess that's more prosaic and instantly understandable. So the whole point of that column was a tongue-in-cheek make fun of the ODT for publishing stories about cats stuck in trees. It was sort of a celebration as well. It was meant to hold up this thing as a lovable pinnacle of the community. And yeah, I think with the put your name to any critiques you have, I think I'm flexible on it, because there are some great Substacks that are anonymous for various reasons. And sometimes it's because they're written by insiders from an industry. And if they're exposed, they might lose their job. But because they have that position, they have a lot of insight that is worth paying attention to. But I do think that if you're going to sit from the comfort of your armchair and fire off these criticisms of people who are building, then you ought to put your name to it. And stand behind whatever critiques you're lobbying there, because it's too easy to throw grenades without actually having to be on the front lines.
The man in the arena, etc. Let's keep pulling that thread. I want to get out of Otago, and you went to Hong Kong and then sort of journalism generally. And it's pretty obvious there's a lot of inspiration for the Substack, you know, Mission Today back in those days. Can you put us in the shoes of a journalist in sort of the 2010s? You were independent at times. You were writing at Pando Daily for a while.
Yeah, well, I went to Hong Kong straight out of journalism school because Hong Kong was booming as an economy and it was on the doorstep of mainland China, which was just about to host the Olympics. I got there in 2006, the Olympics 2008. The rise of China was the big story, and I thought I'll go over there and be a swashbuckling international reporter, a foreign correspondent, and I'll learn Chinese and all this sort of stuff. I got to Hong Kong and it didn't quite work out that way. I ended up sort of writing for an entertainment magazine, Time Out Hong Kong. Actually, I wrote for a publication called Digital Marketing, which was covering the digital marketing industry in Asia. And that was an important year in even though it was a short stint, because that was the year 2007 when Facebook and Twitter were bursting onto the scene and starting to change the landscape of the internet. And also in China, a company called Tencent had launched a thing called WeChat, which is the most powerful social media related communications juggernaut in the world. And I got flown out to Beijing to do a cover story on Tencent and talk to their execs, the CEO and the president at the time. And oh, wow. That was an eye-opening experience. And so I sort of had that kind of like taste of tech and the taste of the revolution already. And then I was in Hong Kong 4 years working for magazines, awesome time, and hooked up with a girl who's American, who later became my wife. Her name's Steph. She came and joined me in Hong Kong for a year. But by that point, I was kind of ready to try something else. And she was ready to move back to the US. So we went to the US and I came over as a freelance journalist. And in that time, trying to scrap by as a freelancer is a really interesting, cool experience. But it's hard. It's hard to make money. You feel very alone. This is in an industry, journalism, media, that was dying. And so each year it became kind of harder for people in that position.
I want to jump on that because it's something that I was trying to wrap my head around earlier, which was when social media first became a thing. You said Twitter and Facebook first burst on the scene in 2007. And that was initially a great thing for journalists because you could just get more readers to your work. You get more eyeballs. But it wasn't for a couple of years after that. Downstream, basically, that the big platforms started to accumulate all the advertising revenue and started to encourage writers to be more clickbaity to optimize for eyeballs. Is that a correct retelling of a story? Or
I think so. In those early days, kind of like the pre-revenue days of those platforms, they were amazing. And people loved them. And for a long time, Facebook was actually untouchable. Even when we started Substack in 2017, people still loved Facebook. Facebook, not Instagram, not Twitter, Facebook. But things started getting bad for them after Trump was elected and everyone decided to blame the social platforms. But yeah, in those early days, it was great. It was great for journalists. They hadn't figured out the maximal version of how do we keep people addicted to these feeds and never leaving these feeds. And those are the kind of dynamics that have started to turn against journalism. The business model thing is not social media's fault. They just built a better system for advertising, and that left traditional media out in the cold because they couldn't compete at that game, really. And so it's been a prolonged dying of traditional media because for various reasons they've either been propped up or they're sort of running on fumes or a billionaire has taken them over. But their business model has not been working for a long time. They've been doomed for a long time. And there hasn't been the radical kind of reinvention that is needed for the media ecosystem to be rebuilt. And so that's what we're trying to do with Substack. We're actually trying to fuse the best of social media with the best of traditional media. Traditional media has a physical illness. It's dying because of its business model. Whereas social media, its business model is doing just fine, but it has a mental illness. The behaviors on social media are like driving us apart as a society and making it harder for us to speak truth and harder to understand each other and work together. But these two things are symbiotic. They actually feed each other when they're working well, but they can't really truly be symbiotic because the business models are in conflict with each other. So one has to die, which leaves us with this anemic system. So Substack's approach is to unify that and tie it to a business model that works in favor of writers and creators and publishers, which results in them doing better, which results in them creating better work, which results in the consumers getting better information, better content, better entertainment.
I love that fusing of the better parts of two otherwise broken systems example. That makes a lot of sense. Was that insight there at the very start when you decided to get into bed with your co-founders to build this, to go through YC? Was there like this grand vision, or was it just publishing tools suck, let's build a better one?
There was actually that grand vision, and credit for this goes to Chris Best, who's the CEO here. It started off just me and Chris Gerard, who's the CTO, joined very soon after that. But the way Substack started, the way he kind of convinced me to get aboard and start this with him is he wrote a blog post that he never published, but he asked for my feedback on. And in that blog post, he was decrying how the incentives of social media break a lot of things in the media ecosystem, which then go on and break things in society. So when your incentive is to get as much engagement as possible and for the social media platforms to keep people addicted to their feeds, then you get rewarded for stuff that like keeps people scrolling for one more thing, for one more dopamine hit. And often that's not trustworthy news stories and reporting that seeks to build nuanced understanding. Often it's cheap outrage, polarizing kind of behaviors and clickbaity type of stuff, fake news type of stuff. And the problem he was identifying is that it's not just bad that that exists in the social media sphere and all the individuals have to play by that game, but all the media institutions have to play by that game as well, because they relied on these big platforms for distribution, for getting audience, and their own business models were failing. And so the whole system ends up broken. We decided the thing that had to change was that advertising couldn't be at the center of it. You had to have readers becoming the customers so that readers could pay the writers and the media institutions who they trust. And that the thing that gets monetized in that case is this trust relationship, not any one viral piece of content or not one addictive feed that keeps people trapped in that game that's impossible to win.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the trust, it had to be with the individual writer, not the institution. Because when you say mainstream media business model had broken, you know, some of the big guys in mainstream media are doing pretty well.
There's about five that are onto subscriptions and doing well, and the global digital giants.
How does that dynamic fit in? Basically, you're capturing and empowering the long tail of independent writers. They also saw the writing on the wall around the death of, you know, advertising as a business model, you know, as compared to the social media networks, but they all managed to switch to subscription. And did they just have like the gravity to be able to pull off that switch?
No, basically they did. New York Times wrote a sort of famous report identifying their big challenges and what would have to change. And then they changed, and it's a really impressive story. And New York Times has done an amazing job of this, converting itself into a subscription first business, basically. And they have a ton of resources, and they have the gravitas of the brand, and they have good storytellers. I mean, they've got New York in the name, but people in New Zealand read the New York Times. And so with those conditions, and yeah, there are going to be some giant media businesses that can survive and actually thrive with that model. That's not everything. The middle class gets wiped out. The middle class is all the city newspapers. Actually, a lot of the New Zealand news institutions are suffering from this exact same thing. You know, all the local towns, all the local news, those are the things that struggle. So that is the sort of beating heart of the middle class media, is the thing that needs to be revived. This is the institution that needs to be rebuilt.
There's a name for this, and I think you might have even sent me this, but Ben Thompson from Stratechery called it the smiling curve. It's as the internet enters an industry, kind of empowers the big, fully integrated players, and then creates a desire for differentiated, independent entrepreneurial players, but squashes the middle. I remember seeing that in Substack and thinking like, wow. And again, so the insight was that, yes, there is a desire for lots of independent voices, but there's no business model that actually supports and sustains those independent writers.
There were a sort of hints of this model being good before Substack came along. So Ben Thompson is one of the, we sort of modeled the early stages of Substack around the Ben Thompson model, Stratechery, where an individual can create their own publication, go direct to their readers and be paid by subscriptions and do really well. By the time we started Substack, we figured he was already making seven figures in annual revenue from a newsletter. Most people would have been shocked to have learned that at the time. But Andrew Sullivan had done something back in the day with the Daily Dish, where he asked people to subscribe at a lower dollar amount and for a higher volume than what he does now on Substack. And that was successful. But we're also encouraged by the success of like The Information and The Athletic, who are doing well with by leaning into quality and focus and having a good price on a subscription for it. So yeah, we believe that this kind of model could work. And if it worked, then it could let in, you called it capturing the long tail, but I kind of feel it like it unlocks energy from the universe. All of a sudden, millions of more people can participate in this economy. You can try something and find out if it's going to work within a couple of days or a month. You can have an idea for a new publication, a magazine or a newspaper type thing, or a podcast or a video show now at breakfast time and be making money from it at lunchtime. And it just unlocks all this, unlocks this new energy that makes the media more democratic, allows a lot more voices in, there's a lot more diversity of perspectives and interests. And that is actually, it turned out that our bet on that was right. That has played out in Substack.
Tell me more about that. I mean, one of the things I loved, I'm not sure if this is currently running, but at one point in the last couple of years, you had a program that would basically make it easier for more of those people to take the leap to start newsletters. Obviously, there's a little bit like maybe a valley of death. They've still got to, you know, build their subscription base to the point where it's sustainable for them to be a writer. And you had a, was it a grant program or like a pro program or something?
We call it pro, where it's kind of like a get started package for people who might otherwise have not done a Substack, who may not have sort of pursued their dream to build their own thing, their own institution around the things that they really care about and find important. Because often in the cases we're dealing with journalists who are like laid off, and so they don't have a big financial cushion, or they're at a company that isn't doing well and, you know, layoffs might be in the future, but they want to hold on to that security as long as they can. Or they're successful and they can say no to so many projects and they have so many things going on, then why would they do a full-time commitment to something like Substack? And we believed in the model. We'd seen it work a lot by that point, and we just wanted them to get started and take away that financial barrier for them. And so we came up with this financial package, essentially, that gave them an upfront minimum guarantee that was good for a year. And during that period, we'd keep 85% of the subscription revenue from their publication instead of 10%. And at the end of that year, it would flip and they would go to the standard model, which is no minimum guarantee anymore, but they get 90% of the subscription model revenue and we take 10. That helped us basically bootstrap the ecosystem or get the flywheel starting with quality writers and Substack.
Oh, yeah. Are you still running that today? And what have you learned, and or what other experiments are you excited to run to solve that same problem, getting more writers off the sidelines?
We ran that for a good period of time. It might have been a year and a half, or maybe not quite 2 years. And it served a purpose for getting that flywheel spinning. And it became less efficient over time. Like the first deals we did, we're making money on the deals, which was not the point of the deals, but they were profitable. It was profitable to do the deals. And we'd raise a bunch of money from Andreessen Horowitz and the Series B to go after this program, to go and spend money to get the flywheel really spinning. But then in 2022, there was a market turn and fundraising became way more difficult for everyone. You know the game. And at that point, we had to make some tough calls on how we're going to run the company over this pending economic winter. So we cut a bunch of things that were otherwise marketing spend that you'd do in a frothier time. And the pro program had served a purpose for us already. And we like got the flywheel spinning. We didn't need to keep on doing it. And in fact, today we don't do any deals like that, but we're more successful with our writer recruiting than we were in that period. But that's not to say when like that's dead forever. That is a useful tool. And I think it might come back in some way. But one thing we learned from it is you got to be careful because the word gets around. And especially writers who are like hungry for income, they'll start coming looking for paychecks. And that is sort of an adverse selection thing, because you don't want people turning up just to get a paycheck. You want people turning up because they really believe in this model. They think that they can build a better life this way.
Before we move on too far from like alternative business models, because I think this stuff's fascinating. I remember when we first spoke, Medium was the big elephant in the room. And I had this thought in a conversation like, whoa, this could be as big as Medium. Yeah, they were rolling out bundled subscriptions, doing revenue share behind the paywall, some experiments. If I look back now, yeah, you sailed past Medium. I assume you have, because it feels that way. Were there missteps that they took along the way, or pitfalls that you'd try to avoid, or like what other examples could you point to that haven't worked?
Yeah, I love Medium, or I loved Medium. A really beautiful editor. The design is really beautiful. They do care about writers and have tried many things, but they're fundamentally hamstrung by not starting with a simple and transparent business model, a business model that worked. And so they've used the old Silicon Valley playbook, which is the social media model. Go and build a huge audience, aggregate all the people and all the eyeballs, all the attention, and then worry about the business model later. And it turns out it's really hard to like strike upon a business model for writing. And they had several bites at that apple. And each time, before they settle on something, which is what it is now, which is like, you know, $5 a month gets you all you can eat access to everything written on Medium. And it seems to be, I think they've slashed their team a lot and they're now looking, I think it's actually profitable now, which is good. But through not having a clear business model that worked from day one, that meant that every time they pivoted and changed to like find a business model that works, there was a lot of fallout in the process. And the fallout always hurt the writers the most. And so they burned the writers' trust all the way along. You know, by the time Substack came along, quality writers and journalists knew the lessons of working with Medium, which was that nothing had actually worked. Nothing had worked. And a few big trees fell over in the process. The All was one. It was like a much loved blog at the time. The All went all in on Medium, got burned when they changed their business model, and then disappeared. The difference between Medium and Substack, Medium is literally in between. It's the intermediator. It puts itself in between that relationship between writers and the readers. And it's sort of control. It's another old social media way of thinking. We'll be the aggregator. We'll decide where the attention goes and we'll decide where the dollars go. Substack is a facilitator. It takes itself out of that relationship. It considers their writer-reader relationship sacrosanct. And we put ourselves in service of the writers. We can only make money if they make money. The only way we make money is taking a 10% cut of subscription revenue. It completely changes the relationship. It completely puts the pressure on us to respect the trust that the writers have put in us and to help them win.
If I play that back to you, it's basically have a business model and be transparent about it. and understand your customer and really fucking look after them. And in that case, it's sort of obvious to point to some missteps there. And it's even more interesting to talk about how you've evolved, because I think understanding your customer and really looking after them has for you been both central focus and really hard at times, particularly over the last, let's say, 3 or 4 or 5 years, as some of those writers' views and opinions about how you're building and running Substack might have varied from your own. An incredibly volatile time for everybody. And you've sort of put yourself right at this cultural nexus and you know, on top of a big platform where people might find it easier to throw stones. But can you talk, there was a quote I found, I forget what it was now, but it was from you or one of your founders. And it was that from the start, we intended for Substack to be a place where broad array of views could find a home, including and especially those of writers with outsider perspectives. And I love that. But tell me, like, where has that run into problems over time? And how have you gone about trying to satisfy everybody or coming to terms with the fact you can't?
Well, you remember I told you that story about how Chris had written this blog post draft decrying the incentives of social media and how it was leading to this social fracture. What he was talking about in that blog post are basically culture wars. The incentives of the dominant media apparatus, which is heavily dominated by social media, had led to this state of ongoing culture war that was eroding trust in society. And so we always thought, well, Substack is kind of a project to fix the culture wars, which means we're going to have to go through the culture wars. It's unavoidable. It's going to touch us. If we're successful at all, it's going to touch us. It's going to come for us. And another thing that we very firmly believe in, and this is in service of writers, and especially the outsiders, especially the people whose voices are on the margins, one of the services, one of the things that's really important is to stand up for freedom of expression and a free press. And it's a very difficult time in the culture to be taking that stance. Unlike the other social media companies, we're taking a hands-off stance when it comes to content moderation. The fashion for the last 10 years has been to be so scared of misinformation contorting the sort of psychological landscape of society that one needs to take extreme measures to in an attempt to control that, which is basically build a massive content moderation apparatus, which in the, you know, in the case of the likes of Facebook and Twitter, Twitter's different now, but in those days, and Instagram involves tens of thousands of people, billions of dollars are spent, a content policy that in Facebook's case runs something like 150 pages long, ridiculous sort of rules like you can show buttocks, but only if the buttocks are photoshopped onto a body. You can show breasts as long as there's no female presenting nipples. There's like this kind of impossible game. And our thing is bigger problem, the root problem is not that bad people are saying bad things on the internet. It's that you have these models, these business models that encourage and reward bad content, bad behaviors, let them maximize conflict and sensationalism, and that take control and agency away from the people who are doing the work on those platforms and the users themselves. And so Substack's approach to this massive problem in society, the culture wars, is not to come up with a more sophisticated content moderation apparatus, but to offer a different way of doing things, offer a different model, a model that gives writers and readers much more power and much more control. So in Substack, you own your mailing list, you own your content, you even own your payment relationships. You take all that with you anytime you want if you're unhappy with Substack. And some people have been because of our stance on free speech, and they've done that. And then as a reader, you get agency because you can subscribe to the people that you want to support, the people that you want to succeed, the people who you trust. And you can do that with money, which helps them even more and helps sort of realize your values in the world even more. And then those relationships are direct. Like Substack doesn't need to be the manager in between deciding what's good and what's bad. We do have content moderation guidelines, but they're at the protect the platforms at the extremes, and they're like in line with the US First Amendment. So no incitement to violence and no doxing. No porn is one for us. That I guess that's outside the First Amendment, but we don't want Substack to become a porn platform. This position is unpopular in some quarters because there is a mass of believers that content moderation is the way to solve these problems in society. And we don't agree with that. In fact, we think that the approaches to content moderation that social media companies have taken have made the problem worse because they erode trust. And the problem wasn't that people are saying bad things on the internet. The problem was their business models were rewarding and amplifying the people who are saying the bad things on the internet. And so they tried to solve a problem with a different problem and just ended up with two problems, and now it's a huge mess. So Substack is a reset. So when we go through these, we've had two or three controversies. Two of them are rather big and painful. One was that people thought we were giving money to anti-trans people and that we should be kicking these anti-trans people off the platform. This is 2021. Everyone had a different opinion about who counted as anti-trans. Writers left in protest because they thought we were wrong. for our approach. And we just had another one. There was anti-vaxxers. There was a period where everyone wanted us to kick off anyone who didn't full-throatedly support the vaccine mandates around COVID. And we didn't kick them off. And no one left over that, actually. I don't think people were like not that worked up about it. And then the latest one was a journalist who was on Substack until recently, went and looked really hard and found some publications on Substack he reckoned were beyond the pale, white supremacist, Nazi kind of content. And there was a pressure campaign. There was a letter writing campaign. There was a counter response that was even bigger, but the intensity of the feeling from those who were pressuring Substack to do something about the Nazis, and everyone again had a different definition of what counted as a Nazi. That was so intense that some people left in protest, and it got a bunch of headlines in The Atlantic, New York Times. And so it made things extremely uncomfortable. It sucks to go through that stuff. And people call me a Nazi sympathizer, and that I'm literally helping the Nazis to fundraise. And we held the line. We did agree that there are some publications there that should be kicked off because they support like the violent ideologies of the Nazis and cross this line of incitement to violence. The ones that we found from like the journalists themselves who were attacking us during the scouring and presenting these ones to us as like potentially violating, there were a total of 5, and they had an active readership between them of 100 people. No paid subscriptions at all. And so the narrative was based on hot air, but the narrative was enough to create a lot of trouble.
I mean, it's wild. It feels obvious that everybody's aligned that some degree of moderation is required, because even if it's just First Amendment moderation, that's some moderation. It's not like a total Wild West. And perhaps your value set puts that level of moderation very low at or just above the First Amendment, and other people put their moderation set in different camps, and the fact that there's some political bias and where they draw the line for moderation is really part of the problem. Your comment there, I mean, that, to me, that kind of validates the model in a way that the worst offending accounts had a collective 100 subscriptions between them.
Not even subscriptions, just people read it, just active readers.
And ironically, the people who are trying to amplify the fact that they shouldn't exist probably directed a lot of attention to them as well.
No one knew these things existed on Substack, including us. The greatest service that anyone ever did to them was write a piece in The Atlantic saying that they exist.
It's wild, you know, to have been through all of that from your perspective as well. I certainly respect, you know, the defining of values and then the constant demonstration of them. And I'm sure you'll have many challenges ahead as you go. In 2023, you waded sort of deeper into the culture wars by saying not only are we going to allow people to write to their subscribers, but to publish notes into sort of more of a social media style, Twitter style platform. I'm really curious with this. I think it's something you were planning to do anyway, but it kind of coincided with Elon's takeover of Twitter. It's working today. It hasn't taken over Twitter, but it's still there. What are your reflections on what could have gone better in the Notes launch? And also, like, how could people engage with it? How should I be engaging with Notes more?
Yeah, so what happened is we launched a Twitter-like feed within the Substack app to give people a place to publish short-form stuff and be in conversation with each other so that their posts, their work, and their profiles could spread and they could grow, they could find growth. We want writers to grow because that's the only way we grow. And it's like Twitter in as much as an electric car is like a gasoline car. Petrol car, sorry. They look the same. They've got some key features that are the same: steering wheel, wheels, windshield, etc. But petrol cars powered by an internal combustion engine that requires you to go dig fossil fuels out of the ground and then burn them. And electric cars powered by a big battery that can draw from a clean energy grid and makes entirely new things possible with that car as well as the energy system around it. And so the major reason for doing it is because these conversational platforms, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, the likes, have been fundamental to helping writers and creators grow, whether they're on Substack or on Patreon or on their own stack, whatever. But increasingly, they are totally unreliable partners. Every time they change their rules or their ranking algorithms, entire businesses can get wiped out, and writers in particular. And increasingly, these platforms don't want you to leave their feed. And so they don't give any priority to links that come from outside sources. And so Elon accelerated the process when, after we announced that we had launched this thing called Notes, he interpreted it as an attempt to kill Twitter and nuked us and nuked all the Substack links and went on a major Substack suppression campaign. It got ridiculous. At some point, if you search for Substack and Twitter, it wouldn't return any Substack results. It would just return results for newsletter. He had to undo that because that was ridiculous, but he put like a delay on a Substack link. So if you, 5 seconds, it wouldn't load for 5 seconds.
Can I ask, because you knew Elon through, well, I don't know if you say knew, but you were working for him as a chief writer, a head writer at Tesla for a while. Did you have the opportunity to sort of engage personally around that time?
Elon hired me to go work for Tesla. I was working for Pando Daily as a reporter. I'd written some things that he liked. I got in touch with him because a different publisher said, hey, do you think there's a way to do a good book about Elon? And I said, well, I'll see if I can convince him to participate in such a thing. And when I got in touch with him, he's like, well, I don't know about the book, but how about coming to work for Tesla? And I tried to convince him to do the book, and we discussed for a while, and eventually it was like too hard. So I said, well, let's just call the book a maybe, because coming to work for Tesla would be a crazy, interesting experience. We've been in a bunch of meetings and calls together. I don't know if he now knows that I'm one of the founders of Substack, but he's talked to Chris quite a bit, our CEO, and he was talking to him a little bit around that time. It started off really friendly and then turned really hostile. And give me some, like, that's a bit of a scoop I just gave you.
Yeah. I'm sure Elon's going to be listening to this podcast as well. So when he does, he'll amplify it.
Yeah. Well, because you're publishing on Substack, it'll probably travel everywhere. So yeah, we're not on friendly terms with Elon. We're not trying to kill Twitter, but we are trying to build a better media ecosystem. And if we're successful at that, then Twitter might become less relevant in the discourse.
Oh, there's a couple of themes here I think are really fascinating. You said a lot of the platforms are prioritizing their own native content. It's true on LinkedIn. It's true on Twitter for sure. There was a tweet that caught my eye. Nat Leisen, if I'm pronouncing that right, put out a spicy, I'm sad the newsletter era is ending. You know, it was a fun period of internet culture, and then expanded on, say, like, basically email is becoming less of how people subscribe to things. And in fact, if you want to build an audience, you need to play the algorithms. I know that you've always had this pretty strong position around readers should have direct relationships, and you didn't want to have this recommendation algorithm. So I'm curious for your counter to that thesis.
I think people get all tangled up with newsletter or newsletter economy, or thinking that the thing is newsletters or that the thing is email, and that's the special source. And we misled people a little bit by saying that Substack was a platform for paid newsletters in the early days. And New York Times thought, okay, we'll compete by launching a bunch of newsletters. And The Atlantic said, we'll compete by launching a bunch of newsletters. And Ghost said, well, we'll just add newsletters. And then Beehive said, we can be a newsletter platform. So all these people are like rushing to the newsletter space. But what really matters is that direct relationship. And email is one of the tools you might use to sort of facilitate that relationship and reach people and distribute. But that exists also in the Substack app, or each writer has a Substack website that any reader can go to. Play the algorithms thing. I don't believe that we're going to live in a world where all the good stuff is published on Twitter in long form. Elon is trying to make happen. I don't think that's their game, and it's all too irrevocably funded to advertising. So you're going to have this aggregator effect where the aggregator still gets to decide who gets attention and who gets money, and the direct relationships are secondary if they're there at all. A different take on the play the algorithms thing is that online conversation has been the greatest discovery engine ever built for media. This is that two pieces of the media before. There's traditional media that makes the stuff, and then there's social media that has the conversation around the stuff and sends people to the stuff, and the stuff looks for the conversations. Unfortunately, though, the institution that makes the stuff is getting corroded by the success of the social media apparatus. So that is why I kind of agree with Nate on that. I wouldn't say play the algorithm, but the online conversation is inseparable from the stuff that gets made. However, that is broken, and that's why we're trying to build that into the same place in Substack.
You published something recently about upgrading Substack's recommendation network. Tell us about that. And also, a thing I've always been curious about is, like, is there a filter bubble risk here as well? Like, if I'm subscribing to one author and they recommend other authors who they feel very aligned with, are they just reinforcing my view of the world rather than expanding my view of the world?
It's interesting. People actually want filter bubbles, I think. There were people complaining today that they're seeing too much right-wing bullshit in their notes feeds, and can we get it out of their feeds? So they don't really want to be exposed to the alternative view. However, like, I think what you want to do if you're conscious of that is to make your media diet decisions really consciously. Look for the people who have integrity and are not just selling you the shit that they think you want to eat all the time. And then those people, because you trust them already, will recommend other people who they trust, and you can get into that virtuous trust cycle. So the recommendations work like that. It's writers recommending each other, where the writers become the sort of ranking algorithm for you. And that is a major feature for growth on Substack. 25% of paid subscriptions generated across Substack are mostly attributed to this feature, recommendations. It's a juggernaut. And then Notes, which is this Twitter type thing that lives within Substack, is algorithmically ranked and is supposed to be fun and snacky. But the key difference is the thing that it is seeking. It is not seeking to keep you stuck in the feed forever. It's not optimizing for time spent. It's not optimizing for ad revenue. It's optimizing for things that will lead to revenue for the writers. It's a totally different game. So can the writer show that they're quality enough that they deserve your paid subscription? And can notes, can the algorithm be in service of that healthier dynamic? And that creates an entirely different experience. And yeah, it's not as big as Twitter, not yet. It's small. It's small and cozy and fun and high quality, but it's really growing and it's really starting to drive growth. We just celebrated the 1 year anniversary of it. And I published a post this morning talking about some of the growth that Notes has been driving. And it's early days, but it's pretty exciting.
Well, I opened all my research tabs yesterday, so I missed that one, but I'll go check it out. Let's talk about AI for a second. I know we're coming up on the clock here, but there was a line, I don't know where to attribute this game, but it's basically like, in an age of AI, content's going to be commoditized, but content isn't culture, and Substack wants to be a nexus for culture. What does that even mean? Break it down for us. And what do you think about generative AI in the 5 to 10 years that's coming for writers?
That was something I wrote. I didn't use the word nexus. That was probably a better word. Content isn't culture. Yeah. These AI tools, the generative AI tools in particular, are amazing, and they are going to revolutionize the world. They already are revolutionizing Substack's business. We don't have to hire another customer support person probably because we have a customer support bot that gets extremely accurate responses instantly. So all that stuff is true. We are believers that the AI revolution is going to happen, whether you like it or not. We also believe is that it's probably going to result in a bunch more good things. It gives people superpowers, even writers. However, they're totally commoditizing the creation of content. It's easy to create an image, an essay, even a movie, a song. And so content, which was already like abundant and being stripped of its value generally, is going to become even less valuable over time. But that leaves relationships as a thing that is truly valuable. A relationship with a human who you trust, that you can help see the world through their eyes, who you feel like you're in communion with. That's what Substack is, basically. Substack is a marketplace for these human-to-human relationships based on the sharing of culture. So we think that this is a great position to be in, and the AI revolution, kind of feel like Substack is going to be the business model for the AI revolution.
And I think if everything you say is true, then human-to-human contacts, relationships are going to be even more important. So that's a really exciting view of the future. To wrap on that section of, I want to carve another minute out at the end if we can, because my favorite thing to do with these podcasts is just basically ask, like, how can we help? You're part of this network and would love to hear your asks. What can we send your way?
Writers, for sure. Creators, podcasters, video makers, people who have something to say and they've got a particular voice and worldview and high quality thought who can contribute to the improving of the media ecosystem generally. You know, everyone's got one writer in mind who they would happily pay $5 a month for to subscribe just to get their stuff. And tell us who that writer is. And better yet, if that's you, come to Substack, give us an introduction. That would be huge for us. We're trying to like just keep on building the ecosystem and keep on attracting the world's best cultural talent to the platform. And it's going to be a forever project.
You wrote a piece a couple years ago about what the New Zealand media could look like if it were reinvented. Has there been any movement on that front? Tell us about local news and should there be people out there covering the regions or the local niches within a country like this?
There should be. And I think there are some like rumblings of that kind of thing cooking in the background. I've heard of one or two projects, but it's still early.
Do you have a dream writer who you'd love to see on Substack? And or a writer who is on Substack that you think is a must subscribe?
There's some amazing writers. Ted Joy is one I recommend a lot. He writes about music and culture. Joy is G-I-O-I-A. He founded the Jazz Studies Department at Stanford. And he's just a really wise head and experienced practitioner. He used to be a business and consultant as well. So he's very broad background. He's got a thing called The Honest Broker. That's really terrific. There's a guy, and like for pure writing, the politics will turn some people off, but as an interesting Substack and beautiful writing and crazy storytelling, there's a guy called Sam Criss, K-R-I-S-S, who's worth paying real close attention to. There's a handful of great New Zealand Substacks, The Kaka, Webworm, Emily Wright's, The Bounce by Dylan Cleaver, and a bunch of others, and I'm sorry for not listing here, but I will take too long to list everyone. They're all worth paying attention to. I'm proud that that New Zealand contingent's on Substack and doing well.
Maybe we should get a local cluster. I'm sure you have this already, but where could I go to substack.com/New Zealand, find all the local writers?
Yeah, you can go to substack.com/globe and find the top 10 publications by country.
I'm totally going to do that. And before I get distracted going elsewhere, let's wrap up for now. Hamish, that was amazing. Thank you so much for going over with me. And we'll get these asks pushed out into the universe and hope to see some good people coming your way.
Awesome, David. Thanks very much.